The information provided in this episode is drawn from corroborated and confirmed factual evidence and contains only information that can be substantiated by those involved with the incidents mentioned therein or officially verified accounts. We are aware that there are many who have conducted their own research into this subject and may feel that they have found anterior details or evidence surrounding this case. However, we at Dead Soul Social Club firmly believe that conjecture and speculation without firm scientific or provable evidence can harm a case or the reputations of those involved going forward. So we stick to only what can be considered solid, provable evidence and factual, corroborated information. Please stay tuned until the end of this episode for information regarding our sources and research documents. Thank you.
Is based on true events.
Ghosts. Dead Soul Social Club investigation. Welcome back, everyone. I hope you're all keeping well. We're going to be conducting a different kind of episode tonight, one that took around 6 months in the planning and execution, and one we have built up since the start of the year. This episode all started with a direct message on Instagram, and resulted in the first Dead Soul Social Club scientific investigation into unknown phenomenon. The investigation is one that me and my team are quite proud of, but also one that we learned a lot from, especially in how we'll do things moving forward. But we'll come to that in part two. In part one tonight, we're going to explore how the investigation came about and our preliminary thoughts on the phenomenon of ghosts. In part two, which will follow, we'll reveal what our research and investigation found and more so, provide you with something that will likely chill, confuse, scare, and leave you terror-struck. I couldn't be more real and honest when I say this. So let's begin. Some food for thought as we dig in tonight is that skepticism is at the heart of science. Always make sure you are open to the knowledge that you might be wrong. Embrace that and move forward, but don't be held back by it. The following account, as I previously mentioned, was submitted by a listener via direct message on Instagram, a listener who has chosen to remain anonymous at this time. The message reads, I grew up in a small English village named Chillingford. It's in Oxfordshire and about 10 miles southeast of the city of Oxford itself. It's a hamlet really, consisting of a handful of houses, a local shop and a hotel, and lots of rural fields. Growing up, it felt like the smallest and most remote village in the world. I was raised by my grandparents, who were incredible parents to me, great role models and were very loving, caring and world-wise. Growing up in their house, something never quite felt right, however. There was always a strange feeling in the back of my mind, in the pit of my stomach even, almost an anxious feeling, like being on edge, like something was about to happen at any moment. When I think back to my childhood, I have two sets of memories. One set is the standard set of memories, you know, the lovely family holidays, great Christmases, friends and school and birthdays and so on. My other set of memories, well, they almost seem like they're from a different life, almost someone else's. They're memories of crushing fear, horror, panic, and a creeping darkness. When I was around 7 years old, my grandfather and I stayed up late one weekend. We were watching a movie together, which was one of my most favorite things in the world to do with my grandfather. When the movie ended, I remember it being about 2:15 a.m. Well, it was exactly 2:15 a.m. I know this because when the film ended, my grandfather said, "It's late, what's the time?" I looked and told him, and we headed to bed, but it stuck with me for some reason. The next morning was Saturday, and at that age, I would get up early to watch the early run of cartoons from 7 to 9 a.m. So I got up, as usual, headed downstairs and popped on the television, just in time for Transformers to be starting. Same as any other Saturday, really. I sat myself down on my knees in front of the television, in the standard position, you know, where your grandma would tell you that you'll get square eyes if you keep sitting that close. I noticed, though, that the clock on the VCR, hey, it was the 90s, was flashing 0114. How is that reset? I half thought, paying more attention to the cartoon. But noticing that made me take a look at the time of the clock on the wall. It had also stopped at 0114. I could hear my grandma in the kitchen starting breakfast, so I got up and headed out. "Morning, love," she said as I walked in, but I hardly took notice. I was looking at the clock on the kitchen wall. It had stopped at 0114 too. "Oh, the clock has stopped," my grandma said, seeing that I was looking at it with prolonged interest. "So have the two in the living room," I said. I headed upstairs to wake my grandpa, passing the huge grandfather clock in the hall and my grandparents' alarm clock in their bedroom, which had both stopped at, you guessed it, 0114. That was the first one. The first time something happened that I can remember feeling strange about. It didn't seem right in my head, how five clocks had all stopped and were showing the same time, a time that hadn't passed between when I went to bed and woke back up. I vaguely remember overhearing my grandparents talk about it. The conversation had an air of mystery. They were in the kitchen and I was in the living room. There was something I was very creeped out about, but I'm not sure why when I overheard the conversation. Now, my grandparents had a big old house. It had four bedrooms. I had one. My grandparents had one. There was a guest room, and I had a playroom full of my toys, which was at the back of the house. That playroom, no matter what the weather, no matter what time of the year, was always freezing cold. The rest of the house might be sweltering hot. Even if the central heating was turned up in the house, that room was always so cold you could see your breath in front of your face like a chilly winter morning. I'd often play in there with a hoodie zipped up and with my hood up. In that room, above the door, was a glass window. It was just plain glass that looked through into the upstairs hallway. I always remember being too afraid to look up at that window. A wave of fear would hit me now and again, and under no circumstances could I bring myself to look up at the window because when I was around 9 years old, I was sat on the floor of that room playing with Legos, and I got a feeling, a sudden urge to look up at the window. And so I did. In the window, for a fleeting moment, was a face looking back at me. A young face, male or female, I wasn't sure, and no one that I recognized. I jumped, startled, and could hear the sound outside the door of someone running down the hallway away from my playroom. It was the sound that left me more terrified and petrified to the spot, and a sound I can still hear today. Brief, fleeting sights can be a number of things, or even a trick of the mind, but to have it accompanied by the unmistakable sound of something running on 2 feet is unmistakable. Also, bear in mind that the door to my playroom was around 7 foot tall, so the window above it was even higher, and with nothing to climb on in the hallway outside, anyone peering through that window would have to be very tall, and certainly taller than anyone who lived in that house with me at that time. Have you ever heard the saying that the spirit world lives in your peripheral vision? Well, that was certainly true in that house. Almost daily feelings of dread or fear would spontaneously sweep over me from nowhere. Almost daily, movements in the shadows, in the darkness, would briefly catch the corner of my eye. A continual feeling of someone or something watching me, especially while in my playroom or in the hall downstairs. Certain was I that at the top of the long staircase, in the dark, at the top of the stairs, there was something present. These feelings of fear stayed with me until I left that house at 16. No other places at all in my life have ever given me those feelings, nor did I see these things anywhere else. I knew with every ounce of my being and to my core that there was a presence in that house. Did anyone else in the house notice such things, you're probably wondering? Oh yes, that's for sure. But we'll come to that. While this all went on for years upon years, it wasn't until I was around 13 years old that things took a step further into the weird. Occasionally, on a Saturday or Sunday evening, my grandparents would go out to dinner with their friends, and I would stay home alone, content with my video games or a movie. This particular Sunday had been a day in July, sweltering hot, so I spent much of the day out with friends, riding our bikes, and generally doing what 13-year-olds do. I came home around 5 p.m, knowing that my grandparents were heading out at around 6:30. The house was hot, so I grabbed my Game Boy and headed into the garden. Sitting under our oak tree with a lemonade and bag of Doritos, such was my teenage diet. My grandparents left on time and I stayed in the garden, deeply enthralled in Mario Brothers. Around 3 a.m, I woke up, on my bed, almost startled awake. I wasn't sure why. Now I was confused, as the last thing I can remember was being sat in the garden, in daylight, well, evening light, sat against the tree. At the time, I assumed I'd fallen asleep and my grandpa had carried me inside when he got home, although him or my grandma would usually have just woken me up in that situation normally. That was until the morning when I bounded downstairs for breakfast to be met with a, "Tired last night, were you?" from my grandma. "I guess so. Why?" I replied. My grandmother's response made me freeze with fright. "Well, we got back early ourselves around 10 p.m, and you were already tucked up in bed." I couldn't remember how I got to bed, and whilst I tried to convince myself that maybe I had just forgotten due to tiredness, I knew deep down something wasn't right. I felt anxious, and I tried to retrace my steps, trying to jog my memory. I headed back into the garden to the spot under the oak tree where I was sat. My lemonade, my Game Boy, and my half-eaten bag of Doritos was still there. I would never have gone to bed and left them outside. Especially my beloved Game Boy. I felt strange, butterflies in my stomach, and a million terrifying thoughts going through my head. It's worth mentioning that our nearest neighbor was around half a mile away, and you couldn't see into my grandparents' garden due to the high walls, trees, and bushes, so I'm fairly confident that no one else would have taken me inside the house either. Throughout my teenage years, dozens of strange, unanswered, and eerie instances like this one happened in that house, and only in that house, nowhere else. Many more I could tell you about. At the time, I was always too nervous to speak to anyone about what was happening, mainly because I was scared of what people would think of me if I told them, and also what the explanation might actually be. My grandma passed away when I was 15. Then my grandfather passed away a year later when I was 16. Afterwards, I went to live with my aunt, and my grandparents' house was sold off. I spoke with my aunt shortly after the house sold and said, quite off the cuff, "I'm not sure I'll miss that house. It gave me the creeps." My aunt told me that she felt the same and she couldn't wait to leave home when she went to college. We shared numerous stories of strange things that happened to both of us in the house. She also told me that my other aunt, her sister, also felt exactly the same but refused to talk about it and refused to talk about what happened when she lived there. So chilled had her experiences left her. I asked my aunt why Grandma and Grandpa were not scared or why they didn't leave the house. My aunt replied, "Well, they both spoke to them. They knew them. They knew what went on in that house and had more to do with it than they let on." My aunt wouldn't say much other than that at the time, although I pieced bits of information together over the years from conversations within the family. Conversations that usually took place in corners, on one-to-one bases, and where secrecy was sworn to be kept afterwards. It's something that has always spooked me out, and it's all a secret kept within my family, but something none of us have really shared outside of the family. Now it's almost 20 years later. I've come full circle and my fear has turned to intrigue. I want to know more. I want to know what was in that house and how my grandparents were involved with it. They almost certainly were. It's taken me this long to want to speak about it. And now that most of my family are sadly gone, I don't have the guilt of betraying our family secret by speaking to others. I've barely skimmed the tip of the iceberg, so to say, by telling you what I have and have experienced so far. And there is a hell of a lot more to reveal about that old house. Can you help me, Jamie? I need answers. So, okay, now, take a minute, everyone, to digest that message. I must say, when I received it, it took me a long while to absorb it all, I think. At this point, I'll also add that I'm not betraying anyone's privacy by reading this message on air or sharing this story with you, as the author of this message was actually part of our investigation himself. So I just wanted to add that because I feel that that's fairly important to let you guys know of. Anyway, now, let's get into it. Do you believe in ghosts? If so, then you're not alone. Cultures from all around the world believe in spooks and spirits, with the general consensus from culture to culture being that ghosts are our loved ones that survive death to live in another astral realm. In fact, ghosts are among the most widely believed of all paranormal phenomenon, with millions of people across the globe believing in the existence of ghosts. A 2013 Harris poll found that 43% of Americans believed in the existence of ghosts, which had increased to 45% by 2019. And a YouGov poll identified that 1 in 3 Brits believe in spooks and spirits too. Further, a 2009 Pew Research poll found that 29% of Americans said they had felt as if they had been in touch with someone who had died. We even conducted our own poll of Dead Souls Social Club listeners on Instagram and found that a huge 75% of you told us that you believe in the existence of ghosts. Thanks to all who voted, by the way. The perceived idea that the dead remain with us in spirit form has been with us for a long time, of course. It's an ancient one, in fact, appearing in countless stories throughout the centuries, from the Bible to ancient manuscripts, ancient Greek tomes to Shakespeare's Macbeth and beyond to the present day. Belief in ghosts is part, of course, of a larger web of related paranormal belief and phenomena. Beliefs such as near-death experience, life after death, and spirit communication, for example. The belief, no doubt, offers many, many people comfort. Comfort that there is something better awaiting us after death. Comfort that we will see our lost loved ones again. And comfort that nothing is ever final or conclusional. And who doesn't want to believe that our beloved deceased family members aren't looking out for us and with us always in our times of need? It's one of the pillars of most religions, and both love and longing are some of the most hard to deny emotions. People have tried to, and indeed claim to have actually been successful in the communication with spirits for, again, centuries. In Victorian England, for example, it was fashionable for upper-class ladies to host seances in their parlours and invite friends and spiritual mediums to conduct the event. Ghost clubs that were dedicated to searching for evidence of ghosts and apparitions formed at British universities around the same time, such as at the prestigious Cambridge and Oxford universities. The most prominent of these societal bodies was founded in 1882, and it's the oldest such organisation in the world that is still operating to this day, and it's namely the Society for Psychical Research. In the United States, during the late 1800s, many psychic mediums claimed to speak directly with the dead, but of course many were later exposed as frauds by sceptical investigators such as Harry Houdini. Many, of course, but not all. While spiritual mediumship and communicating with the dead was popular in the 19th century in the Western world, recently ghost hunting has become a worldwide and widespread interest once again. Much of this is down to the global media, able to market shows to translate across cultures. Television shows like the hit sci-fi cable TV series Ghost Hunters, for example, or Britain's long-running Most Haunted. These shows in particular have spawned dozens of spin-offs and copycats. And it's easy to see why these shows are so popular. Their premise is simple. Quite literally, anyone can, so they portray, look for and research ghosts with a level of scientific integrity. The two stars of Ghost Hunters, for example, were quite literally two ordinary guys, plumbers, in fact, if I'm not mistaken. They project an image that you don't need to be a scientist or have any formal training or experience to form your own reputable investigation. I myself was interested by this premise, As someone with a background in science and also former research training, I reached out to one of these groups that were based in London in the UK to see if I could take part in one of their investigations and see what findings and conclusions I could form from the experience. With that, their team reached out and engaged with me and offered to conduct an investigation at a location of my choosing. This was something I was grateful for and pleased to hear, as it gave me confidence in the knowledge that the location would not be known to their team, increasing their credibility in my eyes. Additionally, and you can probably see where this is going, it gave me an opportunity to combine the message that I had received with an interest I had. I'm going to come back to both the investigation and the listener-submitted story in a bit. First, I want to talk about the science and the understanding behind the phenomenon of ghosts. But first, I would like to clarify my stance, if I may. I approached this episode and investigation and the story submitted to me with a level of skepticism, if I'm honest. You see, considering the subjects I research and talk about on this podcast, I've never had a strong belief in the existence of ghosts. Rather, I always thought of ghosts instead of being a physical apparition or phenomenon, but I've considered it to be a psychological manifestation. This stems, I believe, from growing up with my grandfather, who was himself a paranormal investigator and researcher, and he was actually a member of the aforementioned Society for Psychical Research. Yes, it's likely that that's where I've got my interest regarding the subjects that I speak about on this podcast. Anyway, I digress. As a child, I remember his study being full of books and papers and photographs on the subject. I remember people would visit, we would then interview about their experiences, and he would travel away for several days at a time to conduct investigations with his small team of co-investigators and researchers. He was very open in talking about the subject, and he didn't shield me from any of the knowledge that he had and the stories that he had heard. But even though I was exposed to all that from a young age, I never saw or heard anything in my grandfather's research or stories that convinced me the phenomenon of ghosts, hauntings, poltergeists, or paranormal activity was actually real. Nothing that I could believe as a scientific fact. Nothing that wasn't just conjecture or speculation. So one difficulty that has always existed in scientifically evaluating the existence of ghosts is that a surprisingly wide variety of phenomena are often attributed to what a ghost and spirit actually is, such as a door closing on its own, two missing items, and even cold areas in a room, and the vision of a dead relative that appears out of nowhere. In 2016, sociologists Dennis and Michelle Waskell interviewed ghost experiences for a book that they were putting together titled Ghostly Encounters, The Hauntings of Everyday Life. They found that many participants were not sure that they had actually encountered a ghost and remained uncertain that such phenomena was even possible, simply because they did not see something that approximated the conventional image of a, inverted commas, ghost. Instead, many of the respondents were simply convinced that they had experienced something uncanny, something inexplicable, extraordinary, mysterious, or eerie, they said. They added, many people who go on record as claiming to have had a ghostly experience didn't necessarily see anything that most people would recognize as the classic ghost, and in fact, they may have had completely different experiences whose only common factor is that it could not be readily explained. Personal experience is one thing, but scientific evidence is another, and part of the difficulty in investigating ghosts is that there is not one universally agreed upon definition of what a ghost actually is. Some believe that they are spirits of the dead who, for whatever reason, get left behind on their way to the other side. Others will claim that ghosts are instead the energy of those who previously lived, which has been left in the material world to replay select moments of their connected human's previous existence. A psychic medium once told me that a ghost was the life force of a deceased person who could not pass on to heaven or hell as they had unfinished business in the material realm, i.e. the world that we live in, and that needed completing before they could actually move on. Then there are orbs, entities, demons, poltergeists, vapors, and various other categories that, depending on your culture, will depend on the attributes given to them, as well as their specific purpose and characteristics. Confused? Absolutely. Of course, the categories, attributes, and types of ghost are all made up, pure speculation by those who may have experienced something and lent their theory to what they think they saw. Of course, this is the element of discussion around the ghost phenomenon that has always frustrated me. Personal opinion, based on no scientific basis whatsoever, which is peddled as fact. It's widespread and accepted in regards to ghosts, and just about every television show on the subject I have seen, including documentaries, also pushes this narrative, thus resulting in millions believing these theories. It's unfortunate as it brings complete disrepute to the entire subject matter from a scientific standpoint. There are many contradictions inherent in ideas about ghosts. For example, are ghosts material or are they not? Either they can move through solid objects without disturbing them, or they can slam doors shut and throw objects across the room. You can't have both worlds. According to logic and the laws of physics, it's one or the other. If ghosts are human souls, why do they appear clothed and with, presumably soulless, inanimate objects like hats, canes and dresses, not to mention the many reports of ghost trains, cars and carriages? If ghosts are the spirit of those whose deaths were unavenged, then why are there unsolved murders? Since ghosts are said to communicate with psychic mediums and should be able to identify their killers for the police. And so on. Just about any claim about ghosts raises logical reasons to doubt and challenge. Now, those devout believers that are listening right now are likely getting frustrated by the unusual skeptical viewpoint of this podcast. But stick with us, please. This does have a point. Ghost hunters use multiple and somewhat dubious methods to detect the spirit's presences, often including psychics in their investigations. Virtually all ghost hunters, in particular all the ones that I've come across at least, claim to be scientific in nature. And most give the appearance in the use of their high-tech scientific equipment such as Geiger counters, electromagnetic field detectors, EMF, ion detectors, infrared cameras and sensitive microphones, etc. But yet, none of this equipment has ever been shown or proven to actually detect ghosts or any extrasensory phenomenon. Unfortunately for those guys, it's the methodology, knowledge, and the unbiased testing that does. For centuries, people believed that flames turned blue in the presence of ghosts. Today, few people accept that bit of lore, knowingly, through scientific progression, that blue flames are merely more efficient, more heated, and evenly gas-fed in form. But it is likely that many of these signs taken as evidence by today's ghost hunters will be seen as just wrong and antiquated centuries from now. Other researchers claim that the reason ghosts haven't been proven to exist is that we simply don't have the right technology to find or detect the spirit world. But this too can't be correct. Either ghosts exist and appear in our ordinary physical world and can therefore be detected and recorded in photographs, film, video and audio recordings and so on, or they don't. If ghosts exist and can be scientifically detected or recorded, then we should find hard evidence of that. Yet we repeatedly don't. If ghosts exist but cannot be scientifically detected or recorded, then all the photos, videos, audio and other recordings claimed to be evidence of ghosts cannot be ghosts. With so many basic contradictory theories and so little science brought to bear on the topic, it's not surprising that despite the efforts of thousands of ghost hunters on television and elsewhere for decades, if not over a century, not a single piece of hard evidence of ghosts has been found. And of course, with the recent development of ghost apps for smartphones, it's easier than ever to create seemingly spooky images and share them on social media, making separating fact from fiction even more difficult for ghost researchers. You have to remember that a lot of photographs and videos claiming to be ghosts, recorded on today's technology, is almost impossible to disprove, also by today's technology. So why do so many people believe? Well, most people who believe in ghosts do so because of some personal experience. Perhaps they grew up in a home where the existence of friendly spirits was taken for granted, for example. Or they had some unnerving experience in the past. However, many people believe that support for the existence of ghosts can be found in no less a hard science than modern physics. It is widely claimed that Albert Einstein suggested a scientific basis for the reality of ghosts based on the first law of thermodynamics. That is, if energy cannot be created or destroyed, but only change form, then what happens to our body's energy when we die? Could that somehow be manifested as what we perceive as a ghost? So is that the basis for scientific evidence of spectral entities? Thermodynamics? It seems like a reasonable assumption. Unless, of course, you understand the basics of physics, including the first law of thermodynamics. The answer is very simple, and not at all mysterious, unfortunately. After a person dies, the energy in his or her body goes where all organisms' energy goes after death, into the physical environment. The energy is released in the form of heat, and the body is transformed into the animals that eat us, such as wild animals if we are left unburied, or worms and bacteria if we are interred, and so on. And the plants that in turn absorb us. So there is no bodily energy that survives death to be detected with popular ghost hunting devices that we know or can prove, of course. By the same basic logic, where would the energy go if a deceased individual crossed over to the other side, to use as a somewhat religious term? While amateur ghost hunters like to consider themselves at the forefront of ghost research, they are really engaging in what folklorists call ostension or legend tripping. It's fundamentally a form of play acting, though not always viewed that way by the executioner, or at least not outwardly self-aware of it, in which people act out a legend often involving ghosts or supernatural elements, albeit with a factor of self-belief. In his book Aliens, Ghosts and Cults, Legends We Live, folklorist Bill Ellis points out that ghost hunters themselves often take the research seriously and venture out to challenge supernatural beings, confront them in consciously dramatized form, then return to safely. The stated purpose of such activities is not entertainment, but a sincere effort to test and define boundaries of the real and paranormal world. The practice comes with an established psychological framework. If ghosts are real, and are some sort of as yet unknown energy or entity, then their existence will, like all other scientific discoveries, be discovered and verified by scientists through controlled experiments, not, unfortunately, by weekend ghost hunters wandering around abandoned houses in the dark late of night with cameras and flashlights. Additionally to that, why do ghosts only seem to appear in abandoned buildings, dark buildings, and places with an existing eerie feel or vibe to them? Why don't they appear in normal people's houses in broad daylight or in a really busy auditorium building with hundreds of people around? Food for thought. Despite mountains of ambiguous photos, sounds, and videos, the evidence of ghosts is no better today than it was a year ago, a decade ago, or even a century ago, which, in a time of great and mobile technology, only raises further questions about doubt. There are two possible reasons for the failure of ghost hunters to find good evidence. The first is that ghosts just simply don't exist, and that reports of ghosts can be explained by psychology, misperceptions, mistakes, and hoaxes. The second option is that ghosts do exist, but that ghost hunters need to bring more science to the search. Whilst this might seem fairly pessimistic and dismissive of the phenomenon, it's merely a factual perspective. But many feel, of course, that there is evidence of ghosts. Further, why do so many find positive results by using the same consistent methods of investigation? That's also food for thought. Well, the most common methods of ghost detection are thus. I've pieced together a bit of a list, if you will. Firstly, variations in the electromagnetic field. So ghost hunters use a tool called an electromagnetic field meter to detect ghosts. They refer to it as an EMF detector. More commonly, these tools are used to identify problems with electric power lines, electrical wiring, and electrical appliances. Electromagnetic fields are everywhere in various forms, both naturally occurring and projected from man-made devices and structures, for example. Some scientists say that our perceptions of ghosts may have something to do with those electromagnetic fields. In the 1980s, neuroscientists Michael Persinger hypothesized that excessive magnetic stimulation of the brain led to out-of-body experiences. According to the journal Nature, Persinger had people wear helmets that targeted their temporal lobes with weak magnetic fields, and he found that around 80% of people felt an unexplained presence in the room when this was conducted, which is very interesting, don't you think? Secondly is variations in infrasound. Now, infrasound are sounds below the range of hearing, human hearing. Some animals, including elephants and dogs, can hear it, but we humans can't. However, studies have indicated that humans feel some of the effects of infrasound, including nausea, disorientation, and general unpleasantness. In one 1998 scientific paper, engineer Vic Tandy investigated his own experiences in a supposedly haunted laboratory. While working there, he and others experienced feelings of distress and depression. Cold shivers, they heard sounds seeming to come from unexpected places, and Tandy even saw an apparition of a human figure. Now, while investigating, Tandy found that he and his colleagues were sharing their lab with a low-frequency stand-in wave, which was caused by a new fan in the extraction system. Tandy concluded a 19 Hz stand-in air wave may, under certain conditions, create a sensory phenomena suggestive of a ghost or haunting. Other scientists have conducted similar experiments with similar conclusions. In one study, psychologist Richard Wiseman from the University of Herefordshire in England arranged for people to attend two concerts, one that featured infrasound and one that didn't. 22% of audience members in the infrasound concert reported feeling uneasy, sorrowful, getting chills down the spine, and nervous feelings of revulsion and fear. Again, interesting. Carbon monoxide. Okay, so in a popular TED Talk, journalist Carrie Poppy tells the story of being haunted. Now, this TED Talk is available on YouTube, by the way, so I do urge you to search it out and watch it for yourself. It's titled A Scientific Approach to the Paranormal. It's super interesting, and I think it answers a lot of questions that you might have, so definitely check it out if you get the opportunity. Poppy felt like she was being watched, experienced a feeling of pressure on her chest, and heard whooshing and whispering sounds, and would cry most nights. She was convinced that her house was haunted by a spirit or entity. So then she posted about her experience on a forum for ghost skeptics, who told her it sounded like she had carbon monoxide poisoning. She called the gas company, and they were in fact right. And Poppy isn't alone. Several other haunted houses have been discovered to be the site of carbon monoxide leaks. And this is one of the most common outcomes to ghost and haunting investigations. Pure and simple, carbon monoxide. So if you haven't already in your house, like a lot of you will probably have smoke detectors, maybe get yourself a carbon monoxide detector before you call the Ghostbusters. So next up, we have sleep paralysis. And some scientists say ghosts are likely the result of sleep paralysis. Now, this occurs when there's a disconnect between the body and mind when you are going into or out of REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. The result is a feeling of paralysis and of a waking dream, or often a nightmare. Some people have visions where they feel something is trying to strangle or choke them, or they have a sense of impending doom. Dr. Priyanka Yadav, a sleep specialist at the Somerset Medical Sleep for Life Center in Hillsborough, New Jersey, said, "They'll often see someone coming into their room, and they're not able to move or talk or scream or do anything. Scientists say this is the reason ghosts usually haunt at night, and it's a very plausible explanation for apparition sightings." For those of you who have experienced sleep paralysis, and before you send me a direct message or an email, obviously this is not the sole explanation for sleep paralysis. And further down the line, we will do a full episode on sleep paralysis and so on. I'm someone who has experienced sleep paralysis myself, and this doesn't necessarily fit my idea of what sleep paralysis is. So this is just one of the possible explanations for it, okay? So next up is toxic mold. Many haunted houses are creepy and old, it comes by definition, and may be home to toxic or black mold. A recent study found that microtoxins, or toxins produced by fungi which causes acute toxicity, can lead to delirium, dementia, pain syndromes, movement disorders, and even balance or coordination disorders. Toxic mold is common and occurs in many cold, damp, and older buildings. It also occurs with commonality in buildings which aren't insulated effectively, or which are exposed to some capacity to the natural elements. Obviously, this insulation wouldn't have occurred in older buildings either if they haven't since been updated or treated to current standards. Schizophrenia. In one 1994 study, found a correlation between belief in the paranormal and the MMPIs on the schizophrenia scale, but only in regards to men. Several scientists have speculated that ghosts may be common daytime hallucinations caused by schizophrenia or other such mental illnesses. Similarly, in cases of dementia, many patients with dementia have reported seeing ghosts, and hallucinations are one of the symptoms of dementia. It's so common, in fact, that there's a term for it, and it's called nearing death awareness. And it's where those who are dying and seem to be in and out of this world and the next often find their deceased loved ones present, and they communicate with them. In many cases, the pre-deceased loved ones seem, to the dying person, to be aiding them in their transition to the next world. Now, Rebecca Valla, a psychiatrist in Winston-Salem in North Carolina, told the Washington Post this, which I find quite interesting again. And there are actually reports of when the brain is in the final stages of life, that it releases certain chemicals that affect things like near-death experience and seeing ghosts and apparitions and so on. So again, I think that's worth looking into and researching further. Imagination. Now, if you're hearing about a ghost from a young kid, scientists say it's likely just their imagination. Children are hardwired to learn through imaginative and pretend play, and therefore they can slip between reality and fantasy much more easily than adults. Alita G. Angelosante, PhD, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at NYU, previously told Refinery29 that while an adult might dismiss something they see quickly out of the corner of their eye as nothing, or have a reality-based explanation, children might insist that they saw a ghost or a fairy or some other creature because they don't have that mature explanation capacity yet. They haven't yet developed it. Now, blind spots in our vision. If you ever see something spooky out of the corner of your eye, then turn to see nothing there, you know that sometimes our peripheral vision just isn't that accurate. As Psychology Today explains, each eye has a blind spot about 18 degrees to either side. Our brain compensates for what our peripheral vision can't see by making educated guesses about what we're looking at, and its editing is highly based by expectations, history, context, and desires. Now, the problem is, sometimes these guesses are wrong, and we think we are seeing things that aren't really there. And some scientists say that ghosts can be explained by these wrong guesses and the brain interpreting things incorrectly. Next up is the power of suggestion. Now, scientists say that we've heard so many ghost stories growing up, it's only natural that we think that we see ghosts. One study examined how this works. Participants watched a video of a psychic seemingly bending a key with psychokinesis, and were then exposed to a negative, positive, or no social influence. People who were exposed to the positive social influence, someone telling them they definitely saw the key bend, were more likely to report also seeing the key bend. And again, I think that comes down to, you know, as well as the power of suggestion, various mind tricks and so on, which I'm going to talk about in part two of this investigation. However, experts in other fields say that ghosts fall outside the realm of what scientists can prove or disprove. Writing for the BBC, anthropologist and mythology scholar Tack Thompson points out that many cultures believe in ghosts, and that this belief is even more predominant in Asia than it is in the United States or the United Kingdom. In fact, about 90% of Taiwanese people report having encountered ghosts. Ghosts across cultures, he adds, are often seeking justice from beyond the grave. They could make such demands from individuals or from societies as a whole. As in reports of sightings of the ghosts of murdered slaves and Native Americans in the US, in this way, ghosts reveal the shadow side of ethics. Their sightings are often a reminder that ethics and morality transcend our lives, and that ethical lapses can carry a heavy spiritual burden, he writes. And people who work as mediums and psychics, of course, also believe that ghosts are real. And while it is a special gift to communicate with spirits, it is possible to learn the process. A medium and author known as Elizabeth Owens previously told Refinery29. So while you won't find any scientific studies proving that ghosts are real, a quick Google or a question posed to friends will no doubt uncover dozens of ghost stories. And as for whether these experiences were a trick of the mind or a real encounter, well, that's something you will have to decide for yourself. But, and this is a big but, as with all that scientific knowledge and belief, I still want the opportunity to find more answers. So let me backtrack a moment. Everything I've spoken about thus far has seemed fairly pessimistic and from the viewpoint of a non-believer. And whilst I appreciate that probably is the case, I prefer to think of my stance more as a scientific approach. Like every other episode me and my team have produced, we have relied solely upon hard evidence and probable facts. Like our disclaimer states, everything we present to you, we know in the strongest belief that we are telling you the utmost scientific and truthful detail. Some things in areas and subjects like tonight's episode may be left a hypothesis, but that hypothesis is solely based on evidential details and only when there is no known universal outcome or explanation, as there is with the ghost phenomenon. Now I'm going to lay what I believe bare and on the table. I firmly believe that the phenomenon of ghosts is firmly based in human and animal psychology. That's not to say people are crazy, far from it. But I believe that ghostly paranormal experiences are not physical, but psychological experience triggered by real-world factors. That has been my stance for many years, and was even the basis of a university psychology thesis I completed. So it's something I spent a great deal of time, effort, and work completing, and all the research and evidence that I did and completed pointed to that outcome. Now, all of that aside, I had still received an extremely intriguing message from a very credible listener who I genuinely wanted to help. And additionally, with that, I felt that my mind was open enough to take on board new data and information and allow the opinions and research of others to be considered, which would only produce two positives for me. Either I was correct in what I believed, or I would gain further understanding and evidence which only supported further knowledge and could lead to an even greater understanding of an as yet undiscovered scientific country. So, with that, my team and I sat down around a table and discussed the message we had received and the individual who sent it. We were keen before any investigation took place that we needed more information. We needed all the information if we were going to form an outcome to this story. As I mentioned previously, the listener who contacted us wished to remain anonymous, so for the sake of this series of episodes, we are going to refer to him as Martin. Now, Martin originally contacted us in September 2019. The message I read at the start of this episode is what he first sent to us. It took around 2 weeks for me to sit down, absorb what he had to say, and then discuss it with my team. Now, there are three in my team, and we all felt the same about the message and all had the same questions, concerns, methodology and structure on how to proceed. Firstly, I messaged Martin. I had him confirm all the details he shared with us with a sworn truth and asked him for his contact details. From there, my team and I called him on one miserably wet Sunday afternoon and spent around 3.5 hours questioning him and gathering as much extra information as we could. And there was quite a lot to collect. Between the end of September and the end of December 2019, my team and I spoke with Martin another 4 times via telephone for the purpose of data gathering, totaling almost 20 hours of recorded conversation and questioning. In December 2019, we also met Martin in London, where he agreed to an arranged lie detector examination at the British Polygraph Testing Association. For the record, he passed on all questions. Throughout the entirety of my team's questioning, we also threw some questions and information into the conversation that was designed to trip him up or catch him out if he wasn't being entirely truthful. Again, Martin didn't trip up with his story once, and we found him to be thoroughly honest and truthful the entire time. Through all of this, all of our conversations, the polygraph test, speaking with him in person or over the phone, we never discussed with him if we believed him, thought his story was true or credible, or discussed with him what else we were doing behind the scenes. This gave him lots to think over and be concerned about if he wasn't being truthful. However, he does know now and knows why we did it, and he completely understands, by the way, the reason for this. In January 2020, my team and I began the task of research on Martin's family background. We started with his family tree, which we were lucky enough to trace back to the 1700s. Thank you, ancestry.co.uk. From there, we researched into the details of the lives of his individual family members from around 1900 until the present day. We were confident we knew more about his family history than he did. In fact, we knew we did, as Martin had since told us he knew very little about his family, and that included family members who were still alive during his lifetime and who he knew personally. Things that he did know about his family, and microscopic parts of his story that we got during our conversations, matched up perfectly with our own independent research, so that gave us a feeling of confidence in Martin and our research going in the right direction. It was about the same time in January that I reached out to a professional paranormal research group. I spent a few weeks exchanging messages with them to ensure they were the right people to assist with this investigation, for even though my team and I had a solid game plan, we wanted to see how the guys who complete these investigations on a weekly basis conduct them too. One of the things I agreed with the investigation team early on was that I wouldn't mention their name or their company or give their contact details out in our podcast in any way. So letting them know early on they would get no publicity from this investigation. And they were fine with that, which again allowed me to assert credibility into the purpose of what we were doing. My team and their team agreed in early February 2020 that we would conduct a joint investigation of a location of our choosing, and one they would not know the location of until the day the investigation starts. Worth noting too is that Martin's story has never been published anywhere, and no paranormal team, investigators, or anyone of similar ilk has been told about Martin's story nor researched it in any way. This was again an ideal scenario for us, as it meant no one could find out any information and fake anything during the investigation without doing substantial research first. Finally, at the end of February 2020, we contacted Martin and confirmed that we would be conducting a full paranormal investigation into the home of his youth and would attempt to provide him with some answers. We informed him that as well as my team, there would be an additional team of professionals on site during the investigation too. And finally, we would require his presence there. We felt that 2 days and nights at the property would be sufficient, and he agreed. A member of my team had already agreed the permission to conduct the investigation with the property owners, ideal at that time as the property was actually uninhabited. We told Martin that the investigation would take place sometime during March 2020, and we would give him just 24 hours advance knowledge of when it would be and where he had to be. For the record, Martin now lives in Norwich, which is about 2.5 hours and 117 miles northeast of London, and about 3 hours and 170 miles northeast of Shillingford, where the investigation would take place. So our plan was a good one. Arrangements were all solid, and this was it. On Saturday, March 14th, 2020, our investigation would begin. For me, what was paramount was that not only we follow the established protocols for a paranormal investigation, but we also have ways to test any anomalies found so that we can lock down its authenticity. Additionally, it was important that we would monitor the other investigation team so we could be sure of their data and guarantee a backup of any finding that they may discover. This also meant that my team and I had to read volumes of books and documents which talked about ghost investigations and the so-called science behind paranormal investigation. And whilst 95% were bullshit, there were some which I felt covered things and did things really well. And I'll add them to the resources section at the end of episode 2 should you wish to read them as well. For the record, and for all those tech-minded listeners out there, the list of what my team took for the investigation includes the following. And bear in mind, this is just my investigation, not the London-based investigation team. So my team each took a head-mounted GoPro 4K camera. We took 7 additional cameras to mount in various rooms, including mountains and fixtures. And all of these cameras were capable of shooting in full spectrum, i.e. night mode. We took 4 digital thermometers and 4 manual thermometers, 5 audio recorders, around 10 motion sensors and pressure pads, and corresponding camera for each, 3 EMF meters, 2 EVP recorders, 3 carbon monoxide detectors, 4 N95 face masks, 4 handheld torches, 4 head-mounted torches, 2 still cameras including tripods, 2 pro sound meters, 1 EDI data logger, 2 pairs of thermal goggles, 1 thermal monocular, 4 walkie-talkies, 1 radiation meter or Geiger counter, my personal favourite, at least 2 sets of fully charged batteries for each camera, And each camera was also loaded with a brand new 128GB SD card, and each camera also had two spare 64GB SD cards as standby, a journal and multiple pencils per each person, one Ouija board, I'll explain this in episode 2, and one pet beagle dog called Norman. So these are all the items of equipment that the professional use. Okay, maybe not the Ouija board or the pet dog, but we were more than kitted out to identify what the professionals were capable of identifying and also present a counter-argument where needed. Although it was any discoveries outside these areas that really interested me. So remember, I'm still certain that all the phenomenon can be explained through psychological science at this point. Martin was arriving at the house an hour after us. We would be arriving around 9 a.m. Martin would only be bringing family photos and photo albums and a sweater that he owned when he was 12 years old. The reasons for these items will become apparent in episode 2, by the way. The professional investigator team would bring much the same equipment as us, minus a dog and a few items, but they had one thing that we didn't. A psychic medium who was part of their investigation team. So Mark, a member of my team, was assigned to accompany her for the entire duration of the investigation. Have I told you that Mark's favourite book is 13 Steps by Tony Corinda, by the way? That's right, Mark is an experienced mentalist magician with knowledge of cold reading, hot reading, hypnotism and mind tricks. He especially loves debunking psychics, mediums, spiritualists and faith healers. So anyway, he thought that him and their medium would get on really well, so that was his focus. Grace, my other team member, and I would be monitoring our equipment and documenting the investigation along with the London team. Martin was there for other reasons, shall we say. In part two of this series, we are going to go into the history of Martin's family as well as his family home. We are going to reveal some chilling facts from Martin's childhood and experiences, and we are going to reveal what happened during our investigation and what we found. For reference, there are two significant finds in episode 2 that both surprised and shook both of our teams and genuinely made me reconsider my beliefs into the paranormal and particularly the ghost phenomenon. I urge you not to miss part 2. Until then, take care of yourselves, everyone, and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.